Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Michael Williamson. You might recall he was with us last week. We were talking about the book Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. Michael took some amazing photos in this book. And this is the result of 30 years of research and travel. You and your collaborator on this project, Dale Maharaj, traveled what, 500,000 miles?
Yeah, just together. I mean, I added up in 35 years, 1,350,000 miles of Americana and American road stuff. But just on these projects together, we've done 500,000 together.
Does that include mileage spent hopping freight trains?
Yeah, because it's actually very small. Most of it was by car. Yeah, we tried to figure out how many freight train miles, but, you know, it was in the thousands, but it was nothing like how much we drove. I mean, I always laugh when people say, you know, my dream has been to drive across country, you know, in a car and see America. I'm like, I just did it for the 34th time last summer. And I still love it, don't get me wrong, but we've driven a lot of road. And we stop often. That's the key. For you journalists out there, you got to stop.
I'm from Iowa, and I used to catch the Greyhound frequently that would take the slow route from Des Moines to Iowa City and would veer off to Ames, and then it would go up through Marshalltown and Tama, the old Lincoln Highway. And I understand that you did a book about that. And one of the stops on the Lincoln Highway is Denison, Iowa. And I understand you also did a book about that. I mean, you're constantly working on all these different projects, aren't you?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Iowa. Iowa has become our favorite adopted state, no question about it. And you mentioned all those cities that are, in fact, old Lincoln Highway towns. And the Lincoln Highway book was amazing because it's another one of those things where you think it's just about the road, but it's really about our culture and our changes. And now this strange thing that we're going through, the retro culture. You know what? I did a little talk yesterday and we had this discussion about, the 50s were the good old days. Like, well, for who? A very small segment of society really flourished. And now when I look at all the people interested in backroads travel and history and all this Americana, it gets a little embarrassing that they just remember kind of the cream on top of not the product. But Iowa still stays pretty hardcore to its roots. The people, you know, when you live off the land and there's very little irrigation, you're praying for rain. That's just a different way of living. And so the irony is not only did I do a book on Lincoln Highway, and there's a huge chapter on Iowa in there, but we found this town, Denison. It's over near the Nebraska border, heading over towards there. And it was yet another one of those, everything you want to say about America, you can say through this town. So yeah, we did a book called Denison, Iowa. Dale lived there an entire year. I had to go back and forth because of other projects. But it was like Peyton Place meets Mayberry. And no big city could have topped it for the richness of characters and stories.
And you and Dale first got together 30-some years ago. You were working at the Sacramento Bee. You were a photographer. He was a reporter. And all these years later, now you're a photographer on staff at the Washington Post. Is he still teaching at Columbia University?
Mm-hmm. He is.
So you've both come across country to the East Coast. And I have to wonder, I've been looking through your bio. Were you also a war correspondent or war photographer in Kosovo?
Yeah, I did a lot of conflict photography. We did, you know, stories in the Philippine Revolution, the mid to late 80s, the war in Nicaragua, war in El Salvador. And those stories were not just straight classic conflict reportage. It usually had a social angle. One of the major projects we did in El Salvador was on the sanctuary movement and the people fleeing the death squads settling in the United States. We actually took the trip with them. We went from El Salvador to the United States by foot and car and hitchhiking and being smuggled. So I guess we were doing that embed thing before it was a word. But even then, it had an economic angle about the war economy and who we supported in what country and what companies promoted that policy to sell stuff and then what we did to the people once they came here. So we were always looking like very non-linear, non-direct route to what you were seeing in the paper. But yeah, I did a lot of spent some time in Yugoslavia in the conflict in the Balkans. And, you know, they had it in their head that I do that stuff, But I'm not a conflict photographer, and I'm not a war photographer. I'm a photojournalist who's interested in the impact of – I always deny politics, but in the end, I'm really interested in how politics and policy affect real people and the irony that they think they can't change the course, but if they were more political, they'd realize they could change the final result if they're more active on the front end.
Well, let's talk about how politics impacts real people, and I'll pick an event that happened 30 years ago, about the time you started working on this project, when President Reagan broke the air traffic controller strike. Does that have any significance as to where we're at now?
It does, and again, I try to avoid long discussions about unions, pro-unions, anti-union, whatever. I mean, I'm in the newspaper world. I'm in a union. And you can give all these speeches to the non-union people that your wages are what they are because of the unions. Hey, you like your 40-hour work week and your weekends? Thank you, union. We can give all those speeches. But what really happened with Ronald Reagan was not about being pro or anti-union. It became this idea that you could politicize and demonize people for exercising what were legal rights at the time. And the other remember when even the word liberal got to be, oh, he's a liberal. It was, you know, like maybe, I don't know, maybe sometime in our lifetime calling somebody a Tea Party person might be used in that negative way, like tomorrow. But when we got to this way of speaking where we could use one word, Wisconsin, teachers. Whoa, wow, in my lifetime, teachers demonized? You can trace that back to air traffic controllers, those overpaid, whiny, white-shirted little snobs. Oh, who are just protecting everybody who flies, but I digress. So he did an amazing thing in that he basically said, no middle ground. You're toast. And it made it kind of okay. I remember I covered a lot of campaigns in the 94 Republican Revolution, you know, when Gingrich and company won darn near. I think the only two House races they didn't win were like Huffington in California and one other. I mean, they won everything. And that was that real scorched earth, them and us stuff. Because as much as people make fun of Washington, back in even the Johnson days, those guys did. They went to bars, they smoked cigars, and they cut deals. Hey, I'll give you the gymnasium. You give me the swimming pool. You can name that bridge after your cousin, but I'm going to get this junior college. They just worked it out. These guys went to each other's parties. They hung out even though they were, quote unquote, on the opposite side of the aisle. I might be naive, and it might be much more pronounced many years before, but I really saw something different from Reagan to 94 when we really could demonize the other guys. I mean, if the Democrats were for free baby food that would make every baby really happy and healthy, and it could help the Democrats because they were doing the right thing, the other side would be against it. Even if morally they knew it was cool and it was good for everybody, they could get brownie points off of it. You just be against it because that can't help us politically. So now if you talk about unions and jobs, we have candidates running for president as we speak that have admitted, now hopefully they'll be used in an ad, if the economy stays bad, we benefit. The worse, the better. Now that was Michelle Bachmann in this case. Now, do you really think the current jobs bill has any chance in the world when there's a perception that if it goes through, it could hurt their chances? That's just unprecedented. I mean, at some point, those people on the Hill used to at least go, you know, come on, we do have to do a common good thing at some point. It's not even on the table now.
Well, memories are still fresh of President George W. Bush setting his sights on rolling back Social Security. When we look back at the New Deal and the policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was certainly demonized by a certain percentage of the electorate. You go back and you look at Father Coughlin, and we had that polarization even then, did we not?
We did. And thankfully, the one thing that's been generally true about America, and I hope is still sort of true, it's never really been extreme right wing as a whole or extreme left wing. You know, I always tell people, you know, there is a difference between a right wing nut and a conservative, and there is a difference between a liberal and a lefty bomb thrower. you know, please. So we've always had these elections that in the end, those people in the middle, the 40 to 50% of the people that really aren't extreme in any way, make the difference. Now, in the primaries, we know the red meat thing you got to do to get elected, and you moderate in the fall. Oldest trick in the book. In this case, it's going to be a little dicey because some of the red meat thrown around in order to get elected early on may not go over well if anybody remembers it. But you're exactly right about Roosevelt. We have this history like he saved America, the New Deal, built bridges. He was incredibly hated. I mean, people just thought it was the end of the world and we were going to be, you know, like the Soviet Union. But in the end, enough people did benefit. You know, it wasn't like 6 degrees of separation. It's 1 degree of separation. The bridge was real. My uncle getting the job was real. That school being built was real. And I think that history always treats you kinder when it ended up okay. So, but we have candidates right now that are saying the New Deal was, you know, communist and, you know, Social Security's a Ponzi scheme and other crazy stuff. Like, even really conservative people like those programs. So I'm not really sure if that train of thought's going to carry through. I'm not really afraid of that kind of talk. But I think there is a bit of a risk to have a jobs program in this era because it's very different than the 30s. It's just a much more complicated culture. But, yeah, demonized, that has been going on. But I still say I'm just old enough, seen a few camps. It's meaner because it's not just about I'm going to do this. And it's the other person is not even worth breathing free air.
Well, from my standpoint as an interested observer, I see a lot of the things that President Obama has done so far as being fairly moderate, and yet he's being portrayed as, quote, a socialist, which socialist is like liberal. It's another one of these words that's been demonized. It's become a pejorative term. We have socialist countries out there in the world right now that isn't Sweden supposedly a socialist country? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Bill Maher. And one of the things Bill Maher said, he ran a clip of one of the politicians calling Obama a fascist, communist, socialist, you know. And at one point he stopped and he said, you know, I'm insulted that they use those words. Not because he called them that. Those are really brutal words. That's like Hitler, Mussolini, Pol Pot. You know, you got to earn those words. You got to. And this guy, sorry, has not done anything to earn even I'm a light socialist. He hasn't earned any of that. So the problem with what you're saying, now we're getting into a semantic thing about words. If people don't know their history and they don't read and they have a short-term memory, which politicians exploit every election, you realize that words are more talking points and not this weighty part of history. I mean, in fact, to call somebody a socialist, communist, and a fascist, they're actually kind of they're at odds with each other. It's really hard to be all three. You're a liberal, conservative, independent. I mean, no, at some point you can't be all three. So it's clearly just meat. It's just fodder. Mm-hmm. But it still kind of works, you know. And you are right about the moderation, though, because if you look at Clinton, you know, two terms, Democrat, he was the one that pushed through welfare reform. He was
NAFTA.
Yeah, very centrist. It was partly political survival. It was partly he never was as liberal as people thought. But he was the classic electable Democrat. You know, we all know what happened to, you know, Ed Muskie and Humphrey and, you know, and George McGovern. I mean, anybody that was considered a genuine hardcore lefty didn't have a chance. Just like the real, you know, perceived right-wing nuts like Goldwater or whatever didn't have a chance either.
Well, the spin doctors were really out in force in 1972. We had George McGovern on this program about a year ago, and I think it's often forgotten that George McGovern was a war hero. What can we say? I mean, they spin it and they spin it, and in this upcoming election, it's going to be mind-boggling to see all the spin that we experience. But we are digressing. The book is Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. And we've been joined by Michael Williamson, who took some fabulous photos in this book. Michael is a staff photographer for the Washington Post, and this book is the result of 30 years of research and work with his collaborator, Dale Maharaj. So depression? That's a recession. It's not depression. There's another word.
You know, when we came up with that subtitle, that was the one we thought was going to be the landmine that people would throw at us. Not a word. I remember in the first Great Depression in the mid-80s, the modern, what we call it, the Great Recession, that was the segue. There was a running joke saying, well, is this a recession or is it a depression? And the standard line was, well, if you have a job, it's a recession. If you don't, it's a depression. And we played off that. We remembered that line that several people threw at us back in the 80s. The bottom line is, if you look at these classic economic indicators that they use to say that we're not in an actual full-fledged recession now, they're numbers that they don't mean the same that they used to be. Now, we're not in a free fall. I mean, there's been books written about how scary on the edge we were. And you can talk all you want about TARP and bailout and whatever. You can't prove a negative. We'll never know what would have happened had we not done in terms of infusing. Remember the first depression? Very interesting.
I've heard about it. I don't remember it.
But there was a key that happened in 1937. The whole thing was, you know, jobs, money, build. And in 37, Roosevelt was convinced to peel it back a little bit.
And we went right back into a double dip.
Yeah. So now we've got this crazy, complete non-understanding and remembrance of history with the debt ceiling stuff. Economists with a third grade education can tell you this is not when you start doing austerity programs. You have to beef it up in order to create a robust economy in order to get money later. You just keep – look what happened with the last month's job numbers. 17,000 actual jobs created in August, but 17,000 lost in government, so it was zero. Well, the goal is to have hundreds of thousands of government, not just federal, but municipal, state, and whatever. Well, that's just going to be another – that's not like we got rid of those lazy government workers. Those are real people that, like, pave streets, and they're firemen. Now they're not going to shop at Walmart. They're not going to buy a new windshield, not going to buy a flat-screen TV. You're not going to get any long-term benefit from those people being on the streets.
Well, if you're one of the long-term unemployed with no prospects for getting another job, I think depression is the word, and that's depressing. The book is Someplace Like America. Tell us how you got the title.
Wow. That's – we like irony. We like contrast. So when we heard that in Santa Barbara, California, one of the most affluent parts of California, and things were doing pretty well then because it's not really a factory-based economy. It's agriculture, entertainment, government, high tech. But down in Santa Barbara, there was a lot of homeless people who were living around this huge tree, and there'd been a murder. And what was creepy about the murder, it was a murder of a homeless man, but somebody had posted signs saying, "You other homeless idiots are next." Like, wow. Because there was a lot of new laws. We actually documented 300 laws passed in various states, like it's now illegal to eat out of a dumpster, illegal to sleep in your car, illegal to sleep in a park, you know, you can't take a pack into the store. And it was totally aimed at the have-nots. Well, in Santa Barbara, they'd really had enough. And the police weren't that worried about the sentiment that was very negative. So we followed this little group of folks. It was Crazy Red and wife and couple of the younger guys, and they said, "No, the police come in here and do these evil sweeps. They come in here with batons. They sweep us out of here. They haul us to jail. Some of them, they club us. It's ugly." So being embedded, we just stayed the night with them, hanging out behind this big green dumpster, not far from Route 1. And sure, they came practically on cue, and the cops. Now, we backed off because I wanted to get pictures and we wanted to document. There was no advantage to us being arrested. But we watched them just get hauled away, their junk thrown in the dumpster, grabbed. And Dale was really upset. You know, he just, like, we'd heard the stories, but it was just like these were good old fresh-faced American policemen who looked like really nice gentlemen who were just hauling these guys away like dumpster trash. He couldn't believe his eyes. And at one point he says to Red, he goes, what are they doing? I mean, what's happening here? And Red just looked at him just incredulously with it, like, dude, where do you think you are? Someplace like America? And Dale wrote that in his note, and he sat on that for years. We didn't even use that in the first book. And when we were working on it, he said, you know. So we did this tour when we knew we were going to update our book 30 years later. And we drove through Detroit and all parts of Ohio and Indiana and Kentucky and the coal towns, West Virginia. And what ended up happening was we saw the boarded up houses. And you could see the new ones where the plywood is still orange and the older ones where it's gone gray. And you can see the factories where when you walk, it's just the sound of crunching glass. And it was like the new sound of America and the new view of, oh, we can tell how long that building's been abandoned by the color of the particle board. And I looked at Dale. We remembered the line. I said something like, you know, it is America, but it's like a bad photocopy. It's just someplace kind of like America. You know, like the Soviet Union has these big monolithic buildings, but they're gray and they're boring and they're industrial and they're generic. And it looks like a city, but it's really a barracks. And I just thought, you know, America's still here. Don't get me wrong. But it's kind of someplace like the America we have in our head.
So the America we have in our head is sort of like a Potemkin village? I'm just kidding.
Well, that's why, you know, we were talking about Iowa before. What we know and love about Iowa is still there. They're still farming. There's still cute little buildings and red barns and big silos that have American flags on it. But they're making a third of what they made. They're much more pressure on the typical farmer for what the global economy is. It's still what it is. But there's forces that are much less controllable, much less predictable. And because of that, the consequences are much more devastating when you cross paths with economic fate. Before, auto companies forever had up and down cycles. You know, gas crisis, you know, in the 70s, okay, big cars, you know, Toyota came over here and sold better guys. We'd survived all that kind of stuff. We're talking about major shift in the whole deal. I mean, we're going from an industrial revolution to an information base. We're not making stuff, Vic. We're not making stuff. And when you make a thing, a car needs new tires. It needs that engine tuned. It has this residual effect. My hamburger that I ate at McDonald's, there's no residual nothing from that.
We're busy selling things to each other on eBay.
We're just trading stuff. We're just
stuff
moving
that
stuff
we already
around.
Had that was already made.
Yeah.
In case you just tuned in, my guest is Michael Williamson. The book is Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. He and Dale Maharaj collaborated on this project, recently published by the University of California Press. And it's a big circle. I was reminded of this when I read your book. I realized something. A good friend of mine recently made a documentary film about homeless people in Sacramento. And your book circles around to Sacramento. What is it about Sacramento?
Sacramento has a couple things that have always made it what they call the pass-through town and the big draw town. Now, obviously, it's got a lot of parallels to Washington. It's the capital of the biggest state in the country. And it does have some aspects of its economy that's always been stable. That's agriculture. You know, it's one of those things people got to eat. And one of the things that we saw early on was regular folk, not agricultural workers like migrants from other countries, said, you know, at the very least, I could go out there and pick strawberries. At the very least, I could go hoe sugar beets or watermelons. So people kind of always stood, well, if I'm going to be poor and really in a bad place, at least it's warm and there's still lots of land. So a lot of the folks that end up congregating in Sacramento, where we started our project 30-something years ago, they came there specifically because they knew it wasn't going to happen for them. It might as well not happen in a place that's pretty and warm. And maybe, especially as the laws being much stricter on legal immigration and whether the worker had papers or not, there were raids all the time. And farms did all of a sudden need 300 people, and they needed them legal, and they were taking generic Anglos. We worked in those fields. That was a whole chapter in our previous book, was working the farm fields. We were still a minority. But we met guys from New Jersey. We met guys from Ohio that were out there hoeing and working. We weren't nearly as good as the other workers who've been doing it for years and had it down to a science. And Sacramento reached an apex even just a couple years ago during the height of this most recent depression when it just reached critical mass. Government jobs were lost. High-tech jobs were fading. And this giant tent city. There was a wonderful article, I think it was in The Nation. It had a picture of a blue tarp and a guy sticking. It was called Tarp Nation. And it did this rundown of all these tarp cities around America. The one we profiled was in Nashville. And we touched on it in Sacramento. But the problem with the Sacramento thing is it started actually attracting not, I won't say not legitimate, but just people who thought it was Woodstock. You know, I'm 23 and unemployed. It looks fun. You know, Oprah did a live show from there. After that happened, it actually hurt them because then it was a circus. Then it was a sideshow. Then it was a media event.
I remember as a kid growing up in Iowa, they used to have an annual hobo convention in Britt, Iowa. And you got to know some hobos. And early on in the book, it seems like things in the hobo world kind of took a bad turn and it became very dangerous.
It did. You know, you had mentioned Reagan at one point with the air traffic controllers, but what some people remember in the mental health field, they certainly remember, he was the first to really do the great deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill to save money. Now, on paper, it almost had a bit of a premise in that, wow, $2,000 a month for Fred in an institution at Napa State. You know, why not try this thing, give him $500 a month and a cheap apartment and some counseling? You know, we save money for the state, and maybe Fred can have a chance to be part of society. I'm not blaming, like, some aspects, but it wasn't realistic to how it really works with people who are beyond your basic, just give Fred a pill and he'll be fine. So what we had was a whole breed of shopping cart pushers, people who mumble to the sky, who find, you know, dents of refrigerators. There's Jesus, there's Mary, and, you know, the whole nine yards. And, it was even, you know, country guys sang it in songs. It was referenced in movies. Just mental ill people wandering the streets all over the place. And that started under Reagan in a big way. But it also started this, like, you know, hey, too bad. He's just a nut. He's just a – when we started doing our project, they didn't even call him homeless. They were called bag ladies and winos, shopping cart pushers. You know, the guys in traffic that were, you know, talking to themselves. Now, the problem with these earpiece cell phones, everybody's mentally ill. They're talking to themselves. And I'm not sure if it's to God or to the dent or to their uncle in, you know, Iowa. But the problem we have now is now we really don't have the money for infrastructure for folks like that. So now here's the problem with the mentally ill and the homeless. You might start off saying, you might start off doing okay just out of a job. You spend enough months on that road, you're the guy talking to himself and seeing Jesus in the dent.
Mm. Well, Michael, we really appreciate your time on the program.
It was a pleasure being here.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Michael Williamson. He's a staff photographer for the Washington Post. He took some extraordinary photos, which you can see in this new book that he wrote with Dale Maharaj, called Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week when our guest will be William Kennedy. He has published his first novel in over 10 years, and it is a beauty. William Kennedy will be talking to us about Chungo's beads and two-tone shoes. In the Book Nook next week, his eighth novel in his highly regarded Albany Cycle. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.